expected to terminate in 79 days, the same expectation in days as the newborn female has in years. On the 79th day, if the project is not finished, it will be expected to take another 25 days to complete. But on the 90th day, if the project is still not completed, it should have about 58 days to go. On the 100th, it should have 89 days to go. On the 119th, it should have an extra 149 days. On day 600, if the project is not done, you will be expected to need an extra 1,590 days. As you see, the longer you wait, the longer you will be expected to wait. Let's say you are a refugee waiting for the return to your homeland. Each day that passes, you are getting farther from, not closer to, the day of triumphal return. The same applies to the completion date of your next opera house. If it was expected to take 2 years, and 3 years later you are asking questions, do not expect the project to be completed anytime soon. If wars last on average 6 months, and your conflict has been going on for 2 years, expect another few years of problems. The Arab-Israeli conflict is 60 years old and counting, yet it was considered a simple problem 60 years ago. Always remember that, in a modern environment, wars last longer and kill more people than is typically planned. Another example. Say that you send your favorite author a letter, knowing that he is busy and has a 2-week turnaround. If 3 weeks later your mailbox is still empty, do not expect the letter to come tomorrow. It will take on average another 3 weeks. If 3 months later you still have nothing, you will have to expect to wait another year. Each day will bring you closer to your death, but further from the receipt of the letter. This subtle but extremely consequential property of scalable randomness is unusually counterintuitive. We misunderstand the logic of large deviations from the norm. I will get deeper into these properties of scalable randomness in Part 3, but let us say for now that they are central to our misunderstanding of the business of prediction. Don't cross a river if it is, on average, 4 feet deep. Corporate and government projections have an additional easy-to-spot flaw. They do not attach a possible error rate to their scenarios. Even in the absence of black swans, this omission would be a mistake. I once gave a talk to policy wonks at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington, D.C., challenging them to be aware of our weaknesses in seeing ahead. The attendees were tame and silent. What I was telling them was against everything they believed and stood for. I had gotten carried away with my aggressive message, but they looked thoughtful. Compared to the testosterone-charged characters one encounters in business, I felt guilty for my aggressive stance. Few asked questions. The person who organized the talk and invited me must have been pulling a joke on his colleagues. I was like an aggressive atheist making his case in front of a synod of cardinals while dispensing with the usual formulaic euphemisms. Yet some members of the audience were sympathetic to the message. One anonymous person, he is employed by a governmental agency, explained to me privately after the talk that in January 2004, his department was forecasting the price of oil for 25 years later at $27 a barrel. Slightly higher than what it was at the time. 6 months later, around June 2004, after oil doubled in price, they had to revise their estimate to $54. The price of oil is currently, as I am writing these lines, close to $79 a barrel. It did not dawn on them that it was ludicrous to forecast a second time, given that their forecast was off so early and so markedly, that this business of forecasting had to be somehow questioned. And they were looking 25 years ahead. Nor did it hit them that there was something called an error rate to take into account. Footnote. While forecast errors have always been entertaining, commodity prices have been a great trap for suckers. Consider this 1970 forecast by U.S. officials, signed by the U.S. Secretaries of the Treasury, State, Interior, and Defense. The standard price of foreign crude oil by 1980 may well decline and will in any event not experience a substantial increase. Oil prices went up tenfold by 1980. I just wonder if current forecasters lack an intellectual curiosity or if they are intentionally ignoring forecast errors. Also note this additional aberration. Since high oil prices are marking up their inventories, oil companies are making record bucks and oil executives are getting huge bonuses because they did a good job, as if they brought profits by causing the rise of oil prices. Forecasting without incorporating an error rate uncovers three fallacies, all arising from the same misconception about the nature of uncertainty. The first fallacy, variability matters. The first error lies in taking a projection too seriously without heeding its accuracy. Yet, for planning purposes, the accuracy in your forecast matters far more than the forecast itself. I will explain it as follows. Don't cross a river if it is 4 feet deep on average. You would take a different set of clothes on your trip to some remote destination if I told you that the temperature was expected to be 70 degrees Fahrenheit, with an expected error rate of 40 degrees, than if I told you that my margin of error was only 5 degrees. The policies we need to make decisions on should depend far more on the range of possible outcomes than on the expected final number. I have seen, while working for a bank, how people project cash flows for companies without wrapping them in the thinnest layer of uncertainty. Go to the stockbroker and check on what method they use to forecast sales 10 years ahead to calibrate their valuation models. Go find out how analysts forecast government deficits. Go to a bank or security analysis training program and see how they teach trainees to make assumptions. They do not teach you to build an error rate around those assumptions, but their error rate is so large that it is far more significant than the projection itself. The second fallacy lies in failing to take into account forecast degradation as the projected period lengthens. We do not realize the full extent of the difference between near and far futures, yet the degradation in such forecasting through time becomes evident through simple introspective examination, without even recourse to scientific papers, which on this topic are suspiciously rare. Consider forecasts, whether economic or technological, made in 1905 for the following quarter of a century. How close to the projections did 1925 turn out to be? For a convincing experience, go read George Orwell's 1984, or look at more recent forecasts made in 1975 about the prospects for the new millennium. Many events have taken place and new technologies have appeared that lay outside the forecaster's imaginations. Many more that were expected to take place or appear did not do so. Our forecast errors have traditionally been enormous, and there may be no reasons for us to believe that we are suddenly in a more privileged position to see into the future compared to our blind predecessors. Forecasting by bureaucrats tends to be used for anxiety relief rather than for adequate policymaking. The third fallacy, and perhaps the gravest, concerns a misunderstanding of the random character of the variables being forecast. Owing to the black swan, these variables can accommodate far more optimistic or far more pessimistic scenarios than are currently expected. Recall from my experiment with Dan Goldstein testing the domain specificity of our intuitions, how we tend to make no mistakes in Mediocristan, but make large ones in Extremistan, as we do not realize the consequences of the rare event. What is the implication here? Even if you agree with a given forecast, you have to worry about the real possibility of significant divergence from it. These divergences may be welcomed by a speculator who does not depend on steady income. A retiree, however, with set risk attributes cannot afford such gyrations. I would go even further and, using the argument about the depth of the river, state that it is the lower bound of estimates, i.e. the worst case, that matters when engaging in a policy. The worst case is far more consequential than the forecast itself. This is particularly true if the bad scenario is not acceptable. Yet the current phraseology makes no allowance for that. None. It is often said that is wise he who can see things coming. Perhaps the wise one is the one who knows that he cannot see things far away. Get another job. The two typical replies I face when I question forecasters' business are, What should he do? Do you have a better way for us to predict? And, if you're so smart, show me your own prediction. In fact, the latter question, usually boastfully presented, aims to show the superiority of the practitioner and doer over the philosopher, and mostly comes from people who do not know that I was a trader. If there is one advantage of having been in the daily practice of uncertainty, it is that one does not have to take any crap from bureaucrats. One of my clients asked for my predictions. When I told him I had none, he was offended and decided to dispense with my services. There is, in fact, a routine, unintrospective habit of making businesses answer questionnaires and fill out paragraphs showing their outlooks. I have never had an outlook and have never made professional predictions, but at least I know that I cannot forecast, and a small number of people, those I care about, take that as an asset. There are those people who produce forecasts uncritically. When asked why they forecast, they answer, "Well, that's what we're paid to do here." My suggestion? Get another job. This suggestion is not too demanding. Unless you're a slave, I assume you have some amount of control over your job selection. Otherwise, this becomes a problem of ethics, and a grave one at that. People who are trapped in their jobs, who forecast simply because that's my job, knowing pretty well that their forecast is ineffectual, are not what I would call ethical. What they do is no different from repeating lies simply because it's my job. Anyone who causes harm by forecasting should be treated as either a fool or a liar. Some forecasters cause more damage to society than criminals. Please, don't drive a school bus blindfolded. At JFK. At New York's JFK Airport, you can find gigantic newsstands with walls full of magazines. They are usually manned by a very polite family from the Indian subcontinent. Just the parents. The children are in medical school. These walls present you with the entire corpus of what an informed person needs in order to know what's going on. I wonder how long it would take to read every single one of these magazines, excluding the fishing and motorcycle periodicals, but including the gossip magazines. You might as well have some fun. Half a lifetime? An entire lifetime? Sadly, all this knowledge would not help the reader to forecast what is to happen tomorrow. Actually, it might decrease his ability to forecast. There is another aspect to the problem of prediction, its inherent limitations, those that have little to do with human nature, but instead arise from the very nature of information itself. I have said that the black swan has three attributes: unpredictability, consequences, and retrospective explainability. Let us examine this unpredictability business. Footnote: I owe the reader an answer concerning Catherine's lover count. She had only 12. Chapter 11. How to Look for Bird Poop. Popper's prediction about the predictors. Poincaré plays with billiard balls. Von Hayek is allowed to be irreverent. Anticipation machines. Paul Samuelson wants you to be rational. Beware the philosopher. Demand some certainties. We've seen that A, we tend to both tunnel and think narrowly, epistemic arrogance, and B, our prediction record is highly overestimated. Many people who think they can predict actually can't. We will now go deeper into the unadvertised structural limitations on our ability to predict. These limitations may arise not from us, but from the nature of the activity itself. Too complicated, not just for us, but for any tools we have or can conceivably obtain. Some black swans will remain elusive, enough to kill our forecasts. How to look for bird poop. In the summer of 1998, I worked at a European-owned financial institution. It wanted to distinguish itself by being rigorous and far-sighted. The unit involved in trading had five managers, all serious-looking, always in dark blue suits, even on dress-down Fridays, who had to meet throughout the summer in order to formulate the five-year plan. This was supposed to be a meaty document, a sort of user's manual for the firm. A five-year plan? To a fellow deeply skeptical of the central planner, the notion was ludicrous. Growth within the firm had been organic and unpredictable, bottom-up, not top-down. It was well known that the firm's most lucrative department was the product of a chance call from a customer asking for a specific but strange financial transaction. The firm accidentally realized that they could build a unit just to handle these transactions, since they were profitable, and it rapidly grew to dominate their activities. The managers flew across the world in order to meet, Barcelona, Hong Kong, etc. A lot of miles for a lot of verbiage. Needless to say, they were usually sleep-deprived. Being an executive does not require very developed frontal lobes, but rather a combination of charisma, a capacity to sustain boredom, and the ability to shallowly perform on harrying schedules. Add to these tasks the duty of attending opera performances. The manager sat down to brainstorm during these meetings about, of course, the medium-term future. They wanted to have vision. But then an event occurred that was not in the previous 5-year plan. The black swan of the Russian financial default of 1998 and the accompanying meltdown of the values of Latin American debt markets. It had such an effect on the firm that, although the institution had a sticky employment policy of retaining managers, none of the five was still employed there a month after the sketch of the 1998 5-year plan. Yet I am confident that today their replacements are still meeting to work on the next 5-year plan. We never learn. Inadvertent discoveries. The discovery of human epistemic arrogance, as we saw in the previous chapter, was allegedly inadvertent. But so were many other discoveries as well, many more than we think. The classical model of discovery is as follows. You search for what you know, say, a new way to reach India, and find something you didn't know was there, America. If you think that the inventions we see around us came from someone sitting in a cubicle and concocting them according to a timetable, think again. Almost everything of the moment is the product of serendipity. The term serendipity was coined in a letter by the writer Hugh Walpole, who derived it from a fairy tale, The Three Princes of Serendip. These princes were always making discoveries by accident or sagacity of things which they were not in quest of. In other words, you find something you are not looking for and it changes the world, while wondering after its discovery why it took so long to arrive at something so obvious. No journalist was present when the wheel was invented, but I am ready to bet that people did not just embark on the project of inventing the wheel, the main engine of growth, and then complete it according to a timetable. Likewise with most inventions. Sir Francis Bacon commented that the most important advances are the least predictable ones, those lying out of the path of the imagination. Bacon was not the last intellectual to point this out. The idea keeps popping up, yet then rapidly dying out. Almost half a century ago, the best-selling novelist Arthur Koestler wrote an entire book about it, aptly called The Sleepwalkers. It describes discoverers as sleepwalkers stumbling upon results and not realizing what they have in their hands. We think that the import of Copernicus's discoveries concerning planetary motions was obvious to him and to others in his day. He had been dead 75 years before the authorities started getting offended. Likewise, we think that Galileo was a victim in the name of science. In fact, the church didn't take him too seriously. It seems, rather, that Galileo caused the uproar himself by ruffling a few feathers. At the end of the year in which Darwin and Wallace presented their papers on evolution by natural selection that changed the way we view the world, the president of the Linnaean Society, where the papers were presented, announced that the society saw no striking discovery, nothing in particular that could revolutionize science. We forget about unpredictability when it is our turn to predict. This is why people can read this chapter and similar accounts, agree entirely with them, yet fail to heed their arguments when thinking about the future. Take this dramatic example of a serendipitous discovery. Alexander Fleming was cleaning up his laboratory when he found that penicillium mold had contaminated one of his old experiments. He thus happened upon the antibacterial properties of penicillin, the reason many of us are alive today, including, as I said in Chapter 8, myself, for typhoid fever is often fatal when untreated. True, Fleming was looking for something, but the actual discovery was simply serendipitous. Furthermore, while in hindsight the discovery appears momentous, it took a very long time for health officials to realize the importance of what they had on their hands. Even Fleming lost faith in the idea before it was subsequently revived. In 1965, two radio astronomists at Bell Labs in New Jersey who were mounting a large antenna were bothered by a background noise, a hiss, like the static that you hear when you have bad reception. The noise could not be eradicated, even after they cleaned the bird excrement out of the dish, since they were convinced that bird poop was behind the noise. It took a while for them to figure out that what they were hearing was the trace of the birth of the universe, the cosmic background microwave radiation. This discovery revived the Big Bang Theory, a languishing idea that was posited by earlier researchers. I found the following comments on Bell Labs' website, commenting on how this discovery was one of the century's greatest advances. Dan Stanzione, then Bell Labs president and Lucent's chief operating officer when Penzias, one of the radio astronomers involved in the discovery, retired, said Penzias embodies the creativity and technical excellence that are the hallmarks of Bell Labs. He called him a Renaissance figure who extended our fragile understanding of creation and advanced the frontiers of science in many important areas. Renaissance Schmenaissance. The two fellows were looking for bird poop. Not only were they not looking for anything remotely like the evidence of the Big Bang, but, as usual in these cases, they did not immediately see the importance of their find. Sadly, the physicist Ralph Alpher, the person who initially conceived of the idea, in a paper co-authored with heavyweights George Gemow and Hans Bethe, was surprised to read about the discovery in the New York Times. In fact, in the languishing papers positing the birth of the universe, scientists were doubtful whether such radiation could ever be measured. As happens so often in discovery, those looking for evidence did not find it. Those not looking for it found it, and were hailed as discoverers. We have a paradox. Not only have forecasters generally failed dismally to foresee the drastic changes brought about by unpredictable discoveries, but incremental change has turned out to be generally slower than forecasters expected. When a new technology emerges, we either grossly underestimate or severely overestimate its importance. Thomas Watson, the founder of IBM, once predicted that there would be no need for more than just a handful of computers. That many readers of this book are probably reading these lines not on a screen, but in the pages of that anachronistic device, the book, would seem quite an aberration to certain pundits of the digital revolution. That they are reading them in archaic, messy, and inconsistent English, French, or Swahili instead of in Esperanto defies the predictions of half a century ago that the world would soon be communicating in a logical, unambiguous, and platonically designed lingua franca. Likewise, we are not spending long weekends in space stations as was universally predicted 3 decades ago. In an example of corporate arrogance, after the first moon landing, the now-defunct airline Pan Am took advance bookings for round trips between Earth and the moon. Nice prediction, except that the company failed to foresee that it would be out of business not long after. A solution waiting for a problem. Engineers tend to develop tools for the pleasure of developing tools, not to induce nature to yield its secrets. It so happens that some of these tools bring us more knowledge. Because of the silent evidence effect, we forget to consider tools that accomplished nothing but keeping engineers off the streets. Tools lead to unexpected discoveries, which themselves lead to other unexpected discoveries. But rarely do our tools seem to work as intended. It is only the engineer's gusto and love for the building of toys and machines that contribute to the augmentation of our knowledge. Knowledge does not progress from tools designed to verify or help theories, but rather the opposite. The computer was not built to allow us to develop new, visual, geometric mathematics, but for some other purpose. It happened to allow us to discover mathematical objects that few cared to look for. Nor was the computer invented to let you chat with your friends in Siberia, but it has caused some long-distance relationships to bloom. As an essayist, I can attest that the Internet has helped me to spread my ideas by bypassing journalists. but this was not the stated purpose of its military designer. The laser is a prime illustration of a tool made for a given purpose, actually no real purpose, that then found applications that were not even dreamed of at the time. It was a typical solution looking for a problem. Among the early applications was the surgical stitching of detached retinas. Half a century later, The Economist asked Charles Townes, the alleged inventor of the laser, if he had had retinas on his mind. He had not. He was satisfying his desire to split light beams, and that was that. In fact, Townes's colleagues teased him quite a bit about the irrelevance of his discovery. Yet just consider the effects of the laser in the world around you. Compact discs, eyesight corrections, microsurgery, data storage and retrieval. All unforeseen applications of the technology. Footnote. Most of the debate between creationists and evolutionary theorists, of which I do not partake, lies in the following. Creationists believe that the world comes from some form of design, while evolutionary theorists see the world as a result of random changes by an aimless process. But it is hard to look at a computer or a car and consider them the result of aimless process. Yet they are. We build toys. Some of those toys change the world. Keep searching. In the summer of 2005, I was the guest of a biotech company in California that had found inordinate success. I was greeted with t-shirts and pins showing a bell curve buster and the announcement of the formation of the Fat Tails Club. Fat Tails is a technical term for black swans. This was my first encounter with a firm that lived off black swans of the positive kind. I was told that a scientist managed the company and that he had had the instinct, as a scientist, to just let scientists look wherever their instinct took them. Commercialization came later. My hosts, scientists at heart, understood that research involves a large element of serendipity, which can pay off big as long as one knows how serendipitous the business can be and structures it around that fact. Viagra, which changed the mental outlook and social mores of retired men, was meant to be a hypertension drug. Another hypertension drug led to a hair growth medication. My friend Bruce Goldberg, who understands randomness, calls these unintended side applications corners. While many worry about unintended consequences, technology adventurers thrive on them. The biotech company seemed to follow implicitly, though not explicitly, Louis Pasteur's adage about creating luck by sheer exposure. Luck favors the prepared, Pasteur said, and, like all great discoverers, he knew something about accidental discoveries. The best way to get maximal exposure is to keep researching. Collect opportunities. On that later. To predict the spread of a technology implies predicting a large element of fads and social contagion, which lie outside the objective utility of the technology itself, assuming there is such an animal as objective utility. How many wonderfully useful ideas have ended up in the cemetery, such as the Segway, an electric scooter that, it was prophesied, would change the morphology of cities, and many others? As I was mentally writing these lines, I saw a Time magazine cover at an airport stand announcing the meaningful inventions of the year. These inventions seemed to be meaningful as of the issue date, or perhaps for a couple of weeks after. Journalists can teach us how to not learn. How to predict your predictions. This brings us to Sir Dr. Professor Karl Raimund Popper's attack on historicism. As I said in Chapter 5, this was his most significant insight, but it remains his least known. People who do not really know his work tend to focus on Popperian falsification, which addresses the verification or non-verification of claims. This focus obscures his central idea. He made skepticism a method. He made of a skeptic someone constructive. Just as Karl Marx wrote in great irritation, a diatribe called The Misery of Philosophy, in response to Proudhon's The Philosophy of Misery, Popper, irritated by some of the philosophers of his time who believed in the scientific understanding of history, wrote, as a pun, The Misery of Historicism, which has been translated as The Poverty of Historicism. Footnote. Recall from Chapter 4 how Al-Ghazal and Averroes traded insults through book titles. Perhaps one day I will be lucky enough to read an attack on this book in a diatribe called The White Swan. Popper's insight concerns the limitations in forecasting historical events and the need to downgrade soft areas such as history and social science to a level slightly above aesthetics and entertainment, like butterfly or coin collecting. Popper, having received a classical Viennese education, didn't go quite that far. I do. I am from Amiens. What we call here soft historical sciences are narrative-dependent studies. Popper's central argument is that in order to predict historical events, you need to predict technological innovation, itself fundamentally unpredictable. Fundamentally unpredictable? I will explain what he means using a modern framework. Consider the following property of knowledge. If you expect that you will know tomorrow with certainty that your boyfriend has been cheating on you all this time, then you know today with certainty that your boyfriend is cheating on you and will take action today, say, by grabbing a pair of scissors and angrily cutting all his Ferragamo ties in half. You won't tell yourself, "This is what I will figure out tomorrow, but today is different, so I will ignore the information and have a pleasant dinner." This point can be generalized to all forms of knowledge. There is actually a law in statistics called the law of iterated expectations, which I outline here in its strong form. If I expect to expect something at some date in the future, then I already expect that something at present. Consider the wheel again. If you are a Stone Age historical thinker called on to predict the future in a comprehensive report for your chief tribal planner, you must project the invention of the wheel, or you will miss pretty much all of the action. Now, if you can prophesy the invention of the wheel, you already know what a wheel looks like, and thus you already know how to build a wheel, so you are already on your way. The black swan needs to be predicted. But there is a weaker form of this law of iterated knowledge. It can be phrased as follows. To understand the future to the point of being able to predict it, you need to incorporate elements from this future itself. If you know about the discovery you are about to make in the future, then you have almost made it. Assume that you are a special scholar in medieval university's forecasting department, specializing in the projection of future history, for our purposes, the remote 20th century. You would need to hit upon the inventions of the steam machine, electricity, the atomic bomb, and the internet, as well as the institution of the airplane onboard massage and that strange activity called the business meeting, in which well-fed but sedentary men voluntarily restrict their blood circulation with an expensive device called a necktie. This incapacity is not trivial. The mere knowledge that something has been invented often leads to a series of inventions of a similar nature, even though not a single detail of this invention has been disseminated. There is no need to find the spies and hang them publicly. In mathematics, once a proof of an arcane theorem has been announced, we frequently witness the proliferation of similar proofs coming out of nowhere, with occasional accusations of leakage and plagiarism. There may be no plagiarism. The information that the solution exists is itself a big piece of the solution. By the same logic, we are not easily able to conceive of future inventions. If we were, they would have already been invented. On the day when we are able to foresee inventions, we will be living in a state where everything conceivable has been invented. Our own condition brings to mind the apocryphal story from 1899, when the head of the U.S. Patent Office resigned because he deemed that there was nothing left to discover, except that on that day the resignation would be justified. Footnote: Such claims are not uncommon. For instance, the physicist Albert Michelson imagined, toward the end of the 19th century, that what was left for us to discover in the sciences of nature was no more than fine-tuning our precisions by a few decimal places. Popper was not the first to go after the limits to our knowledge. In Germany, in the late 19th century, Émile Dubois-Raymond claimed that ignoramus et ignorabimus, we are ignorant and will remain so. Somehow his ideas went into oblivion, but not before causing a reaction. The mathematician David Hilbert set to defy him by drawing a list of problems that mathematicians would need to solve over the next century. Even Dubois-Raymond was wrong. We are not even good at understanding the unknowable. Consider the statements we make about things that we will never come to know. We confidently underestimate what knowledge we may acquire in the future. Auguste Comte, the founder of the School of Positivism, which is unfairly accused of aiming at the scientization of everything in sight, declared that mankind would forever remain ignorant of the chemical composition of the fixed stars. But, as Charles Sanders Peirce reported, the ink was scarcely dry upon the printed page before the spectroscope was discovered, and that which he had deemed absolutely unknowable was well on the way of getting ascertained. Ironically, Comte's other projections, concerning what we would come to learn about the workings of society, were grossly and dangerously overstated. He assumed that society was like a clock that would yield its secrets to us. I'll summarize my argument here. Prediction requires knowing about technologies that will be discovered in the future, but that very knowledge would almost automatically allow us to start developing those technologies right away. Ergo, we do not know what we will know. Some might say that the argument as phrased seems obvious, that we always think that we have reached definitive knowledge, but don't notice that those past societies we laugh at also thought the same way. My argument is trivial, so why don't we take it into account? The answer lies in a pathology of human nature. Remember the psychological discussions on asymmetries in the perception of skills in the previous chapter? We see flaws in others and not in ourselves. Once again, we seem to be wonderful at self-deceit machines. The Nth Billiard Ball. Henri Poincaré, in spite of his fame, is regularly considered to be an undervalued scientific thinker, given that it took close to a century for some of his ideas to be appreciated. He was perhaps the last great thinking mathematician, or possibly the reverse, a mathematical thinker. Every time I see a T-shirt bearing a picture of the modern icon Albert Einstein, I cannot help thinking of Poincaré. Einstein is worthy of our reverence, but he has displaced many others. There is so little room in our consciousness. It is winner-take-all up there. Third Republic-style decorum. Again, Poincaré is in a class by himself. I recall my father recommending Poincaré's essays, not just for their scientific content, but for the quality of his French prose. The Grand Master wrote these wonders as serialized articles and composed them like extemporaneous speeches. As in every masterpiece, you see a mixture of repetitions, digressions, everything a Me Too editor with a prepackaged mind would condemn. But these make his text even more readable, owing to an iron consistency of thought. Poincaré became a prolific essayist in his 30s. He seemed in a hurry and died prematurely at 58. He was in such a rush that he did not bother correcting typos and grammatical errors in his text, even after spotting them, since he found doing so a gross misuse of his time. They no longer make geniuses like that, or they no longer let them write in their own way. Poincaré's reputation as a thinker waned rapidly after his death. His idea that concerns us took almost a century to resurface, but in another form. It was indeed a great mistake that I did not carefully read his essays as a child, for in his magisterial La Science et l'Hypothèse, I discovered later, he angrily disparages the use of the bell curve. I will repeat that Poincaré was the true kind of philosopher of science. His philosophizing came from his witnessing the limits of the subject itself, which is what true philosophy is all about. I love to tick off French literary intellectuals by naming Poincaré as my favorite French philosopher. Him a philosophe? What do you mean, monsieur? It is always frustrating to explain to people that the thinkers they put on the pedestals, such as Henri Bergson or Jean-Paul Sartre, are largely the result of fashion production and can't come close to Poincaré in terms of sheer influence that will continue for centuries to come. In fact, there is a scandal of prediction going on here, since it is the French Ministry of National Education that decides who is a philosopher and which philosophers need to be studied. I am looking in Poincaré's picture. He was a bearded, portly, and imposing, well-educated patrician gentleman of the French Third Republic, A man who lived and breathed general science, looked deep into his subject, and had an astonishing breadth of knowledge. He was part of the class of mandarins that gained respectability in the late 19th century. Upper middle class, powerful, but not exceedingly rich. His father was a doctor and professor of medicine. His uncle was a prominent scientist and administrator. And his cousin Raymond became a president of the Republic of France. These were the days when the grandchildren of businessmen and wealthy landowners headed for the intellectual professions. However, I can hardly imagine him on a t-shirt or sticking out his tongue like in that famous picture of Einstein. There is something non-playful about him, a Third Republic style of dignity. In his day, Poincaré was thought to be the king of mathematics and science, except, of course, by a few narrow-minded mathematicians like Charles Hermite, who considered him too intuitive, too intellectual, or too hand-waving. When mathematicians say hand-waving disparagingly about someone's work, it means that the person has A, insight, B, realism, C, something to say, and it means that D, he is right because that's what critics say when they can't find anything more negative. A nod from Poincaré made or broke a career. Many claim that Poincaré figured out relativity before Einstein, and that Einstein got the idea from him, but that he did not make a big deal out of it. These claims are naturally made by the French, but there seems to be some validation from Einstein's friend and biographer Abraham Pais. Poincaré was too aristocratic in both background and demeanor to complain about the ownership of a result. Poincaré is central to this chapter because he lived in an age when we had made extremely rapid intellectual progress in the fields of prediction. Think of celestial mechanics. The scientific revolution made us feel that we were in possession of tools that would allow us to grasp the future. Uncertainty was gone. The universe was like a clock, and by studying the movements of the pieces, we could project into the future. It was only a matter of writing down the right models and having the engineers do the calculations. The future was a mere extension of our technological certainties. The three-body problem. Poincaré was the first known big-gun mathematician to understand and explain that there are fundamental limits to our equations. He introduced non-linearities, small effects that can lead to severe consequences, an idea that later became popular, perhaps a bit too popular, as chaos theory. What's so poisonous about this popularity? Because Poincaré's entire point is about the limits that non-linearities put on forecasting. They are not an invitation to use mathematical techniques to make extended forecasts. Mathematics can show us its own limits rather clearly. There is, as usual, an element of the unexpected in this story. Poincaré initially responded to a competition organized by the mathematician Gösta Mittag Leffer to celebrate the 60th birthday of King Oscar of Sweden. Poincaré's memoir, which was about the stability of the solar system, won the prize that was then the highest scientific honor, as these were the happy days before the Nobel Prize. A problem arose, however, when a mathematical editor checking the memoir before publication realized that there was a calculation error, and that, after consideration, it led to the opposite conclusion. Unpredictability, or more technically, non-integrability. The memoir was discreetly pulled and reissued about a year later. Poincaré's reasoning was simple. As you project into the future, you may need an increasing amount of precision about the dynamics of the process that you are modeling, since your error rate grows very rapidly. The problem is that near precision is not possible, since the degradation of your forecast compounds abruptly. You would eventually need to figure out the past with infinite precision. Poincaré showed this in a very simple case, famously known as the three-body problem. If you have only two planets in a solar-style system, with nothing else affecting their course, then you may be able to indefinitely predict the behavior of these planets. No sweat. But add a third body, say a comet, ever so small, between the planets. Initially, the third body will cause no drift, no impact. Later, with time, its effects on the two other bodies may become explosive. Small differences in where this tiny body is located will eventually dictate the future of the behemoth planets. For a visual example of precision in forecasting, see Figure 2 in the PDF. Explosive forecasting difficulty comes from complicating the mechanics ever so slightly. Our world, unfortunately, is far more complicated than the three-body problem. It contains far more than three objects. We are dealing with what is now called a dynamical system, and the world, we will see, is a little too much of a dynamical system. Think of the difficulty in forecasting in terms of branches growing out of a tree. At every fork, we have a multiplication of new branches. To see how our intuitions about these non-linear multiplicative effects are rather weak, consider this story about the chessboard. The inventor of the chessboard requested the following compensation: 1 grain of rice for the first square, 2 for the second, 4 for the third, 8, then 16, and so on, doubling every time, 64 times. The king granted this request, thinking that the inventor was asking for a pittance. But he soon realized that he was outsmarted. The amount of rice exceeded all possible grain reserves. This multiplicative difficulty, leading to the need for greater and greater precision in assumptions, can be illustrated with the following simple exercise concerning the prediction of the movements of billiard balls on a table. I use the example as computed by the mathematician Michael Berry. If you know a set of basic parameters concerning the ball at rest, can compute the resistance of the table, quite elementary, and can gauge the strength of the impact, then it is rather easy to predict what would happen at the first hit. The second impact becomes more complicated, but possible. You need to be more careful about your knowledge of the initial states, and more precision is called for. The problem is that to correctly compute the ninth impact, you need to take into account the gravitational pull of someone standing next to the table. Modestly, Berry's computations include a weight of less than 150 pounds. And to compute the 56th impact, every single elementary particle of the universe needs to be present in your assumptions. An electron at the edge of the universe, separated from us by 10 billion light years, must figure in the calculations, since it exerts a meaningful effect on the outcome. Now, consider the additional burden of having to incorporate predictions about where these variables will be in the future. Forecasting the motion of a billiard ball on a pool table requires knowledge of the dynamics of the entire universe, down to every single atom. We can easily predict the movements of large objects like planets, though not too far into the future, but the smaller entities can be difficult to figure out, and there are so many more of them. Note that this billiard ball story assumes a plain and simple world. It does not even take into account these crazy social matters possibly endowed with free will. Billiard balls do not have a mind of their own. Nor does our example take into account relativity and quantum effects. Nor did we use the notion, often invoked by phonies, called the uncertainty principle. We are not concerned with the limitations of the precision in measurements done at the subatomic level. We are just dealing with billiard balls. In a dynamical system, where you are considering more than a ball on its own, where trajectories in a way depend on one another, the ability to project into the future is not just reduced, but is subjected to a fundamental limitation. Poincaré proposed that we can only work with qualitative matters. Some property of systems can be discussed, but not computed. You can think rigorously, but you cannot use numbers. Poincaré even invented a field for this, analysis in situ, now part of topology. Prediction and forecasting are a more complicated business than is commonly accepted, but it takes someone who knows mathematics to understand that. To accept it takes both understanding and courage. In the 1960s, the MIT meteorologist Edward Lorenz rediscovered Poincaré's results on his own, once again, by accident. He was producing a computer model of weather dynamics, and he ran a simulation that projected a weather system a few days ahead. Later, he tried to repeat the same simulation with the exact same model and what he thought were the same input parameters, but he got wildly different results. He initially attributed these differences to a computer bug or a calculation error. Computers then were heavier and slower machines that bore no resemblance to what we have today. So users were severely constrained by time. Lorenz subsequently realized that the consequential divergence in his results arose not from error, but from a small rounding in the input parameters. This became known as the butterfly effect, since a butterfly moving its wings in India could cause a hurricane in New York 2 years later. Lorenz's findings generated interest in the field of chaos theory. Naturally, researchers found predecessors to Lorenz's discovery, not only in the work of Poincaré, but also in that of the insightful and intuitive Jacques Adhémar, who thought of the same point around 1898 and then went on to live for almost 7 more decades. He died at the age of 98. Footnote. There are more limits I haven't even attempted to discuss here. I am not even bringing up the class of incomputability people call NP completeness. They still ignore Hayek. Popper and Poincaré's findings limit our ability to see into the future, making it a very complicated reflection of the past, if it is a reflection of the past at all. A potent application in the social world comes from a friend of Sir Karl, the intuitive economist Friedrich Hayek. Hayek is one of the rare celebrated members of his profession, along with J.M. Keynes and G.L.S. Shackle, to focus on true uncertainty, on the limitations of knowledge, on the unread books in Echo's library. In 1974, he received the Bank of Sweden Prize in Economic Sciences in memory of Alfred Nobel, but if you read his acceptance speech, you will be in for a bit of a surprise. It was eloquently called the pretense of knowledge, and he mostly railed about other economists and about the idea of the planner. He argued against the use of the tools of hard science in the social ones, and, depressingly, right before the big boom for these methods in economics. Subsequently, the prevalent use of complicated equations made the environment for true empirical thinkers worse than it was before Hayek wrote his speech. Every year a paper or a book appears, bemoaning the fate of economics and complaining about its attempts to ape physics. The latest I've seen is about how economists should shoot for the role of lowly philosophers rather than that of high priests, yet in one ear and out the other. For Hayek, a true forecast is done organically by a system, not by fiat. One single institution, say, the central planner, cannot aggregate knowledge. Many important pieces of information will be missing. But society as a whole will be able to integrate into its functioning these multiple pieces of information. Society as a whole thinks outside the box. Hayek attacked socialism and managed economies as a product of what I have called a nerd knowledge or Platonicity. Owing to the growth of scientific knowledge, we overestimate our ability to understand the subtle changes that constitute the world and what weight needs to be imparted to each such change. He aptly called this scientism. This disease is severely ingrained in our institutions. It is why I fear governments and large corporations. It is hard to distinguish between them. Governments make forecasts. Companies produce projections. Every year, various forecasters project the level of mortgage rates and the stock market at the end of the following year. Corporations survive not because they have made good forecasts, but because, like the CEOs visiting Wharton I mentioned earlier, they may have been the lucky ones. And, like a restaurant owner, they may be hurting themselves, not us, perhaps helping us and subsidizing our consumption by giving us goods in the process, like cheap telephone calls to the rest of the world funded by the overinvestment during the dot-com era. We consumers can let them forecast all they want if that's what is necessary for them to get into business. Let them go hang themselves if they wish. As a matter of fact, as I mentioned in Chapter 8, we New Yorkers are all benefiting from the quixotic overconfidence of corporations and restaurant entrepreneurs. This is the benefit of capitalism that people discuss the least. But corporations can go bust as often as they like, thus subsidizing us consumers by transferring their wealth into our pockets. The more bankruptcies, the better it is for us, unless they are too big to fail and require subsidies, which is an argument in favor of letting companies go bust early. Government is a more serious business, and we need to make sure we do not pay the price for its folly. As individuals, we should love free markets because operators in them can be as incompetent as they wish. The only criticism one might have of Hayek is that he makes a hard and qualitative distinction between social sciences and physics. He shows that the methods of physics do not translate to its social science siblings, and he blames the engineering-oriented mentality for this. But he was writing at a time when physics, the queen of science, seemed to zoom in our world. It turns out that even the natural sciences are far more complicated than that. He was right about the social sciences. He is certainly right in trusting hard scientists more than social theorizers, but what he said about the weaknesses of social knowledge applies to all knowledge. All knowledge. Why? Because of the confirmation problem, one can argue that we know very little about our natural world. We advertise the read books and forget about the unread ones. Physics has been successful, but it is a narrow field of hard science in which we have been successful, and people tend to generalize that success to all science. It would be preferable if we were better at understanding cancer or the highly nonlinear weather than the origin of the universe. How not to be a nerd. Let us dig deeper into the problem of knowledge and continue the comparison of Fat Tony and Dr. John in Chapter 9. Do nerds tunnel, meaning do they focus on crisp categories and miss sources of uncertainty? Remember from the prologue my presentation of Platonification as a top-down focus on a world composed of these crisp categories. Footnote. This idea pops up here and there in history under different names. Alfred North Whitehead called it the fallacy of misplaced concreteness. For example, the mistake of confusing a model with the physical entity that it means to describe. Think of a bookworm picking up a new language. He will learn, say, Serbo-Croatian or Lung by reading a grammar book cover to cover and memorizing the rules. He will have the impression that some higher grammatical authority set the linguistic regulations so that non-learned, ordinary people could subsequently speak the language. In reality, languages grow organically. Grammar is something people without anything more exciting to do in their lives codify into a book. While the scholastic-minded will memorize declensions, the aplatonic non-nerd will acquire, say, Serbo-Croatian by picking up potential girlfriends in bars on the outskirts of Sarajevo, or talking to cab drivers, then fitting, if needed, grammatical rules to the knowledge he already possesses. Consider again the central planner. As with language, there is no grammatical authority codifying social and economic events. But try to convince a bureaucrat or social scientist that the world might not want to follow his scientific equations. In fact, thinkers of the Austrian school, to which Hayek belonged, used the designations tacit or implicit precisely for that part of knowledge that cannot be written down, but that we should avoid repressing. They made the distinction we saw earlier between know-how and know-what, the latter being more elusive and more prone to nerdification. To clarify, Platonic is top-down, formulaic, closed-minded, self-serving, and commoditized. Aplatonic is bottom-up, open-minded, skeptical, and empirical. The reason for my singling out the great Plato becomes apparent with the following example of the master's thinking. Plato believed that we should use both hands with equal dexterity. It would not make sense otherwise. He considered favoring one limb over the other a deformation caused by the folly of mothers and nurses. Asymmetry bothered him, and he projected his ideas of elegance onto reality. We had to wait until Louis Pasteur to figure out that chemical molecules were either left or right-handed, and that this mattered considerably. One can find similar ideas among several disconnected branches of thinking. The earliest were, as usual, the empirics, whose bottom-up, theory-free, evidence-based medical approach was mostly associated with Philinus of Cos, Serapion of Alexandria, and Glaucius of Tarentum, later made skeptical by Monodotus of Nicomedia, and currently well-known by its vocal practitioner, our friend the great skeptical philosopher Sextus Empiricus. Sextus, who, we saw earlier, was perhaps the first to discuss the black swan. The empirics practiced the medical art without relying on reasoning. They wanted to benefit from chance observations by making guesses, and experimented and tinkered until they found something that worked. They did minimal theorizing. Their methods are being revived today as evidence-based medicine after 2 millennia of persuasion. Consider that before we knew of bacteria and their role in diseases, doctors rejected the practice of hand-washing because it made no sense to them, despite the evidence of a meaningful decrease in hospital deaths. Ignaz Semmelweis, the mid-19th century doctor who promoted the idea of hand-washing, wasn't vindicated until decades after his death. Similarly, it may not make sense that acupuncture works, but if pushing a needle in someone's toe systematically produces relief from pain in properly conducted empirical tests, then it could be that there are functions too complicated for us to understand. So let's go with it for now while keeping our minds open. Academic libertarianism. To borrow from Warren Buffett, don't ask the barber if you need a haircut, and don't ask an academic if what he does is relevant. So I'll end this discussion of Hayek's libertarianism with the following observation. As I've said, the problem with organized knowledge is that there is an occasional divergence of interests between academic guilds and knowledge itself. So I cannot for the life of me understand why today's libertarians do not go after tenured faculty, except perhaps because many libertarians are academics. We saw that companies can go bust, while governments remain. But while governments remain, civil servants can be demoted, and congressmen and senators can be eventually voted out of office. In academia, a tenured faculty is permanent. The business of knowledge has permanent owners. Simply, the charlatan is more the product of control than the result of freedom and lack of structure. Prediction and free will. If you know all possible conditions of a physical system, you can, in theory, though not, as we saw in practice, project its behavior into the future. But this only concerns inanimate objects. We hit a stumbling block when social matters are involved. It is another matter to project a future when humans are involved, if you consider them living beings and endowed with free will. If I can predict all of your actions under given circumstances, then you may not be as free as you think you are. You are an automaton responding to environmental stimuli. You are a slave of destiny. And the illusion of free will could be reduced to an equation that describes the result of interactions among molecules. It would be like studying the mechanics of a clock. A genius with extensive knowledge of the initial conditions and the causal chains would be able to extend his knowledge to the future of your actions. Wouldn't that be stifling? However, if you believe in free will, you can't truly believe in social science and economic projection. You cannot predict how people will act, except, of course, if there is a trick, and that trick is the cord on which neoclassical economics is suspended. You simply assume that individuals will be rational in the future and thus act predictably. There is a strong link between rationality, predictability, and mathematical tractability. A rational individual will perform a unique set of actions in specified circumstances. There is one and only one answer to the question of how rational people, satisfying their best interests, would act. Rational actors must be coherent. They cannot prefer apples to oranges, oranges to pears, then pears to apples. If they did,